Hey everyone, and welcome back to the First Act Podcast. This is part one of what's to come for fandom in the music business, featuring Bryce Carr of Bands in Town, Fender, Rally, and more. Listen in as we break down Bryce's unique path in the music business, along with some iconic changes to come in the entertainment landscape. This is an episode you won't want to miss.
And now, hosted by Harry G, this is your one-stop shop for hot talk straight from the top. Whether you're trying to build a job in pop, rock, or any other artsy schlock, here's your top dog with info that can't be bought, it's gotta be sought. So sit back, crack a six-pack, because we're about to chit-chat and rip facts. It's the First Act Podcast.
Bryce, thank you so much for being on the First Act Podcast.
Thanks, Ben. It's really good to be here. I'm excited to chat with you and catch up and just talk about this crazy world called the music industry.
Yeah, man. I haven't seen you in real life probably since like 2017, if I had to.
Yeah. Yes. No, that sounds right. Running around New York City.
Yeah. Somewhere in Brooklyn. I think Music Hall of Williamsburg, right?
Yeah. Probably having a beer.
Definitely having a beer.
Yeah.
Meeting through Lauren Tibor and going to catch Ezzy.
Mm-hmm.
She was doing her what was it, Five Towns Records promotion thing.
Yeah.
I remember we met that night, and I think that we probably went out for a drink or might have caught a show at Webster Hall or something after that. So for everybody who does not know who Bryce Carr is in the music space, so Bryce has been working, I'd say, mostly in like brand partnerships, right? The last few years of your career.
Yeah, it's been interesting because I think the big thing for me has always been being the face of a company or a brand to artist partners. And as a quick overview, I got started probably when I was in college working for a company called Ultimate Ears. And Ultimate Ears works with artists to create in-ear monitors. So when artists are on stage, they need to be able to hear themselves. So worked with that company for 4 years, went over to Bands in Town, was working on the artist team there for 2 years, left the music industry to go do my MBA for a bit. We met when I was in New York City at Superfly,
right,
working on kind of, you know, their music festival property expansion and all that stuff. And then I spent 3 years at Fender doing artist partnerships, working with artists there, and then just spent a little over a year at a crazy Web3 company working with artists to tell their Web3 story too. So a lot of partnerships on the artist side. That's the commonality for me.
You know, what I really like about your background is it's so traditional that it's not traditional, you know?
Yeah.
It's traditional in the sense that, like, you know, you go and do your undergrad, and then, you know, you work a little bit, you work some internships, you get some experience under your belt, and then you go and you do your MBA, right? In that sense, it's traditional in like every other industry, but in the music space, it's not that common, I would say, to go ahead and get your MBA. A lot of people just kind of like, they throw themselves to the fire and sort of see what sticks. So what kind of benefit would you say that you have from, you know, doing that traditional, non-traditional route?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. You know, I've worked in music for a long time, and I was kind of that young guy that would poke my head in places I probably didn't belong and sneak into dressing rooms to try to hawk product to artists and tour around in dirty bands with clients. But like, what I realized I wanted somewhere along the way was I wanted to be the person that could be equally comfortable in a dirty van touring through the middle of nowhere as I was in a boardroom talking to senior leadership about marketing strategy for a new product. And to me, the path to be able to get both of that was actually by going back to school and doing the MBA. And so that kind of put me into more of a marketer mindset instead of just traditional relationships. How do we talk about the products we're working with in a way that makes sense to artists and ultimately connect that to consumers? I think when you look at artist partnerships, no matter what company you're at, the end goal for that company is always the impact that it has on the end consumer. The artist, by looking at an authentic partnership, is the vehicle that gets you to that end consumer. And so for me, the focus was always, how are we telling that story to the end consumer through the voice of the artist.
And so when you work with artists, are you working with the artists directly, or are you often working with their management team or their agencies or their labels? Like, how does that really work? Keep in mind that a lot of the audiences are on the younger side, right? So a lot of them might not have even had their very first internship yet.
Yeah. I think it's a mix of different things, right? And so you have your artists that like to be very hands-on and like to do it themselves. A big trend that we're seeing more and more in the music space is either just the DIY artist or the artist that has a really robust team, a robust label system, a robust support system, but they, for whatever reason, probably for the right reasons, want to be hands-on and involved. And so in some cases, you're definitely working with artists directly. In other cases, for the work that I've been doing, it gets routed through management, sometimes even agents when you're perhaps working on a little bit more of a brand deal or maybe focused around touring. I've interacted with those individuals too. But then, you know, one of the cool things about this system that has been created in the music industry is artists now have the ability to hire on different team members as they see fit. So it's very similar to like drafting a sports team. When you say, hey, I'm going on tour right now, I need a really good tour marketing agency. Or, hey, I'm working on this crazy Web3 strategy, I need a community manager. And so artists are pulling in the right people for the right job.
So kind of treating artists a little bit more as a business than just as an art form. I mean, like, right? Am I wrong to say that?
It's true. No. It makes perfect sense. And that's you know, we go back to talking about why I wanted to pursue my MBA, but artists are artists. They're focused on art. But at the end of the day, artists deserve to be, they deserve to have income coming in, right? To support the art that they create. It's a necessary part of the full equation. And I wanted to understand how to take something that has historically been so driven by qualitative aspects, such an emotional-based field, and figure out how to apply strategy and data and analytics to it. I think you'll see so many DIY artists that are now getting very, very smart about how they're looking at their growth pattern. It's no longer like, oh, I'm just going to play a show this weekend. It's more about like, oh, where can I break through the noise? Do I have a fan base that I'm seeing emerge in Mexico City? Like, why is my one song popping off in Cleveland, right? Artists are looking at data, even if they don't have a wide team, and they're understanding it on their own and then making those decisions.
I love that you're saying that. And you know, data was very much, I'd say, like Web 2 entering the music industry. And now we're in this whole phase of Web 3, which I do want to save for a little bit of a chat later. But on the data front, so let's say you're an independent artist. Like you were saying, like a lot of these artists are kind of doing their own thing. Like they might not have a whole fleshed out team. From the artist partnership side of things, like how small can an artist be to partner with a company?
Yeah, I think it depends on what the word partnership means, because I consider to a certain extent Spotify having Spotify for artists and creating a tool that any artist can log into and see where their listeners are and how things are trending. To me, that's a partnership. That is a brand that is going out of their way to help serve and support emerging artists. I think depending upon the size of that artist, you'll see different amounts of support, right? So you and I might have a band in our garage and Spotify is supporting us by giving us access to that dashboard. Or you might be Lizzo coming out with a new album and Spotify pulls every lever possible to be able to look good to that artist so that they amplify Spotify links to their fan base. So it really is about what levers you're going to see that company pull based upon the size of you as an artist. Now, that being said, the other important thing is looking at how each of these companies monetize. So Bands in Town, where I spent a few years, monetizes through serving and supporting artists largely through ticket links. So when you click to buy a ticket, Bands in Town sees a little bit of a cut from someone like Ticketmaster. And it's in Bands in Town's best interest to scale and serve every single artist possible, especially because the cost of their service incrementally is so minimal. Someone like Fender, when I was tasked with working on marketing campaigns with artists and trying to figure out who we're going to support, how we're going to support, you know, those guitars can be $2,000 to $5,000, depending upon which one you're looking at. And you have to be a little more choosy around which artists you're going to support and to what degree. So it kind of becomes this necessity with time and the positioning of the company.
Yeah. And, you know, talking a little bit about the Fender side, it sounds to me like the fan base would need to be able to like afford to be able to buy those guitars, right? So if you're looking at, I guess, which following would make sense for that? Would it be younger kids where their parents would spend their spend money to buy these guitars or these instruments for the kids? Or would it be more for like an older demographic for people that would be looking to do this on, you know, kind of like buy it as like a novelty for themselves?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it really goes down to like your product segment mix, right? And if you look at Fender, there's a product category that is based, production is based overseas. So traditionally China or Indonesia, and you'll see a much lower price point. Those are targeted towards younger consumers, the kids, or even just someone that's learning for the first time. So you keep it affordable, but then the artists you use for your marketing campaigns around that need to speak to all of those types of consumers. The second kind of bucket for Fender is products that are made in a factory in Mexico. And, you know, those guitars can be $600, $700, $800, maybe up to $1,000. But when it was my job to look at that and figure out what consumer are we speaking to, well, it's usually someone's second guitar or their first Fender guitar after coming from somewhere else. So we would really lean into the younger demographic around what's big on TikTok or what artists are trending or who's the hottest name on the Lollapalooza lineup, right? Mm-hmm. And you leverage those artists to tell their story through content that speaks to their fans to ultimately drive in additional sales. When you look at some of the more American-made expensive, quote-unquote expensive products, that's where you are, again, speaking to a different consumer. And you have the luxury to maybe pull in perhaps bigger or more established names. And you want kind of a broader appeal on that as well. So it's really about knowing who you're speaking to and how you're going to speak to them.
And so what was a partnership that you bridged at Fender that you were most proud of?
I think one of the most important things for not only anyone that wants to work in the music industry and focus on building relationships between creators and brands, but also any artist that's looking at doing a deal with a brand, really comes down to the authenticity of the relationship. And is this something that feels real? Is this something that fans will look at and not necessarily see it as, oh, the artist is just taking a check, but see it as something that kind of makes sense and is fun? And consumers are smart. They can see right through any of that. One of the things that I really love doing is letting the artists tell their story. And it sounds silly, right? Because you as a brand have some basic angle or position or something that you want the artist to do. But at the same time, if you can get the artist to do what they want to do, everything makes sense. And the ROI you see from fans just is massive because it feels right. So a really good example of that would be when I was at Fender, we launched the artist development program called Fender Next. And that was a program, or still is a program, that works with artists from around the world, up and coming artists, to really show who they are, introduce the world to their music, or regardless of their gender, their race, where they're from, what language they speak, just introducing people to good music and showing that guitar isn't just a bunch of white dudes shredding anymore. It's young people, it's diverse people, it's music that anyone can connect with. So I was really proud of that program and all the different touch points around content and experiential.
For that program, how do you choose the right artist? Because you probably get so many submissions.
Yeah, it's really hard. And that, you know, that's kind of one of the signs that you know that your program is successful, or not even successful, but it's needed. It's something that artists really like. And I look at like Taco Bell's Feed the Beat program, or a lot of these other programs that like, they get a ton of applicants, so to speak. And you see labels pitching, you see artists kind of cold calling, you see all these different things. You know, when a brand is looking at what artist partners to work with, I think, again, they look at kind of their end consumer. And a decision that I would have to look at is, who am I trying to speak to? And for this program, you know, you're lucky because with 25 different artists, you're speaking potentially to 25 different segments of consumers and having to check a lot of different boxes in regard to location, vibe, demographics. I think when you're marketing to a consumer, you want the consumer to be able to see themselves in the brand. And you have the luxury with larger programs when you're looking at multiple artist partners to make sure there are different ways for the consumer to see themselves. So that's a big factor that goes into selecting artist partners.
Great. And have artists, you mentioned that, you know, sometimes artists will cold call and or just like submit themselves blind. Has Fender ever partnered with an artist that might not have had a team that completely submitted, just kind of was entirely independent and only representing themselves?
Yeah, all the time. I don't want to speak for every company. I know every company I've been at, that is a big thing. That's an important thing, right? Like this ecosystem, it's like the music industry industrial complex, right? Everyone always talks about how everything's rigged and the only artists that make it are the artists that are on the big labels. And sure, there are certainly factors around that that make sense. And that's kind of how it works. But at the same time, there are ways for artists to break through that and either do things independently or become an artist that is signed to a major label and can get additional support. I've never been at a company where the decision was made that you could only look at signed artists or you could only work with, for this campaign, you could only work with artist XYZ. What I have been in conversations around is more about the artist reach, right? And there are plenty of amazing independent artists that have reach, have following, have fans that turn up to see them and can sell out shows. And so there's always ways to work with brands if you're an artist that is truly independent and DIY.
Great. You know, I think that's very inspiring to hear. And a lot of artists that would be listening to the podcast or a lot of the viewers or listeners that are working with indie artists to help grow them, it's important for them to understand that it's not a rigged industry, but it reach is a real thing, right?
Yeah.
Community, yes. Reach, following. It's really important to know that there's something there and people need to be able to see that there's something there in order to, you know, actually invest or buy in.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's so interesting to me because I look at Patreon, I think is a really good example of this, where when there's this old mindset that used to exist in the music industry, where you were either shooting for a major label or you were shooting to do everything by yourself. There was no middle ground. You know, if you were an early Patreon artist, like Jack doing Pamplemousse through Patreon, and then also Amanda Palmer, back then, I think, at least to me, it looked very much like, this is how we're going to do it. I'm going to do it all on my own. Mm-hmm. And then you also saw so many of the major label music industrial complex, like, this is how it has to be over here. What's been really, really nice with the emergence of more and more digital tools, it kind of goes back to what I said before, is where you can hire this person to do that for you, and you can hire them to do this. And, you know, you look at a major label who has, I mean, look at Sony right now, and they have The Orchard and they have AOL, right? Like that's a service that is offered to artists instead of having to go to this extreme left or extreme right position. You have different tools that you can pick up. And I think those things are not only great for, in my example, Sony, but they're also great for emerging artists who need a little more help, but they might not quote unquote qualify for that extreme level of support. But It's smart because these major labels now have almost like a farm system, like a sports team where they can say, oh, minor leagues, you're doing really hot. Like this single's exploding. I'm seeing the numbers in real time. I'm going to up level you to my label. And it's working out well for artists to have these offerings that help them grow.
Do you think that labels are necessary?
I love this question. This is like the hottest question. Yes, I 100% think they are. I think what we have seen and will continue to see is that labels offer more services without exclusive contracts. I think it's something that changes what a label actually does, but it also modernizes what a label actually does. You'll always have the major labels that sign big artists and have that business model, and they're signing 100 artists and hope two of them have smash hits because that's making the money. But at the same time, they need to look out for this long tail of artists through distribution deals that bring in money for them. Going off of that idea of like label as a service, people I know at labels are really smart people. They're smart marketers. They're smart around fan engagement. They're smart about radio promo. They know how to do their job well. Mm-hmm. And sure, we see more and more kind of agencies pop out and do their own things and offer those services. But labels continue to do it well, have strong relationships, and have shared services that really actually do support artists. What do you think on that?
No one really asks me about that. You know, I've never really worked at a label, so my opinion might not be the most valid. However, yeah, from my perspective, I do agree with you that labels are going to be offering, or some labels, I should say, are going to be malleable, and they're offering digital tools. I definitely agree with that. And so while their entire business model isn't going to change, maybe a portion of it might change, or they might might invest in one segment of the business a little bit differently that will make up a little bit more of their revenue, I think. Because I'm thinking about it from a business standpoint, right? I think that labels are, while I think the brand recognition is extremely important, I feel like slowly but surely they're becoming less and less important because you're able to do more and more on your own. While, you know, I have this whole philosophy that artists are no longer playing in the music industry. We're all just in the creator economy.
Yep.
And an artist is just a form of creator, which I think has always been the case, but it's more so viewable now. You can really kind of peel back the curtain and see that you can create art in many different ways, and you can showcase your music in so many different ways, and you can really do a lot of this for free and without a big team. You know, if you have the skills to edit video, to record your audio, to write music, and really just take the time to engage with your following, you can make magic happen. And then all of a sudden, everybody wants to, you know, knock on your door for an opportunity.
Yeah. It's an interesting thought, because does that mean that artists have to be multifaceted, more creative, more like, is the... With technology and the emergence of technology, it has become too easy to distribute music and get music out there, and even record music for that matter, which has driven more competition,
right?
Which makes it harder to break through. So you as a creator have to either really, really hustle and be really, really good at your art, or you have to suddenly also create great visual art and dedicate hours a day on TikTok trying to figure out how to break through the noise, right? Like, there's a lot of good that comes with this, but it also means you really have to step up your game if you're a creator to break through.
I agree. And a lot of artists, or a lot of artist teams, or just managers in general, are a little upset by this, because they're saying, well, the artists are already working so hard to write music and to get their music out there and create artwork. Why should they also be a community manager? Why should they also learn about digital strategy and digital marketing tactics? Why should now they have to be a TikToker, right?
Thanks for tuning in to part one. Stay tuned for part two. Remember, new episodes release every Thursday at 12 p.m. Pacific. See you there.